Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
What we hoped in this session that this would be a time when there would be rather wide participation among all those who have participated in the panel and others who are here to help us think creatively about in a positive way about what the future could hold, to try to think of a way in which policies and relationships could be shaped differently. So after the comments of the three panelists this afternoon, I'm going to try to bring up some of the themes that I think I've heard throughout the sessions of a kind of common consensus that might be the basis of a policy statement or a position paper that those of us who have participated in this project can agree upon to share with the broader public and with policymakers. Lloyd and Suzanne Rudolph have been distinguished members of the community of scholars who have focused on South Asia for many years, they were associated with the University of Chicago's Department of Political Science. They've written extensively on South Asian politics and U.S. relations with South Asia, on Gandhi, on Rajasthan regional politics, on so many different things. It is a great pleasure to have both of them in California, where they now live, near Berkeley. And we're delighted that they're here, but also that they're here today to help us think through envisioning a different future. And then Vinay Lal, the Department of History at UCLA, who brings with us brings to us a wide experience in the region, not only historically, but in his recent position as the director of the Education Abroad program at Delhi University. And Vinay, I think you're just fresh back from your tour duty there. Welcome back to California. We're glad to have you with us once again. We'll start with Lloyd and Suzanne Rudolph and then Vinay Lal to help us envision a different future for U.S. relations with India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan.
U.S. did something which is in the lingo of international relations is called offshore balancing. That is, it supported Pakistan, it supported its efforts to balance India, to be equal to India militarily. And we did this because we thought Pakistan was supposed to be helping us in the Cold War, containing Soviet communist forces. Pakistan received huge amounts of aid for many years and used it, of course, to build up a military capable of challenging or balancing or challenging India. And there were three, or depending how you count them, four wars between India and Pakistan. Unipolarity era, Pakistan stopped being a frontline state until the Soviets in 79 came into Afghanistan, and that restarted this whole business of us working with Pakistan and building up Pakistan military and military capabilities. I'm just going to leap forward to the present era, where we see a decline in state sovereignty, where civil wars and non-state actors are becoming more important. Of course, preeminently we see Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda involved in the 9/11 attack on the U.S., but the world now is full of all kinds of security questions, violence questions that have nothing to do with states. It have to do with civil wars and transnational civil society actors. And so we have the decline of state sovereignty and the rise of non-state actors. And so in that context, India has a special strength, in my view. and that is the rise of soft power in the face of hard power. Soft power being the capability of a country to influence public opinion, to persuade people. I'm talking about Bollywood films. I'm talking about Bangalore and high tech. I'm talking about Indian writers winning Booker Prizes, and India all of a sudden became from a land of poverty to a land of opportunity. India and soft power is generated and so I gave you some concrete instances, but in part by what we might call multivocality. That is, you can perceive the country with a variety of identities and voices. So India's diversity, India's pluralism, India's multi-form kind of existence enhances its soft power because it can be many things to many people, and can speak out of its several sides of its mouth at once, if you will, because of this multivocality. So, now the question is, we hopefully talk about this some more. I think India-U.S. relations, starting with the Obama administration coming in. Well, I should back up one more step. Of course, Clinton started vastly improving Indo-U.S. relations, got rid of the hyphen India-PAC. In his famous March 2000 visit to India, spent 5 days in India, 5 hours in Pakistan. Gave a fantastic talk to the Indian Parliament. When he went to Pakistan, he told him, you got to stop this fighting in Kargil, and you've got to have restore democracy and so forth, and sort of gave them a big lecture. So that was the beginning of the de-hyphenization and the better, much improved relations with India. George Bush, one of the few things that he did effectively, and some people, of course, is very controversial, but he did negotiate the nuclear agreement with India. He made him enormously popular in many, but not all, circles in India, including with the present government, Dr. Manmohan Singh, who's been returned to, as they say in India, thumping victory in the just past elections, was the architect of that agreement on the Indian side, and so forth. So now, starting with the Obama administration, where India is, as it used to be in the Cold War, bipolar era, is in a way on the back burner. That was a very chronic place for India to be for 40 years or so, with Pakistan getting all the attention in containment and frontline state status. I'm not sure how it's going to get out of that position. The appointment of Tim Romer, in my limited knowledge of who is to be the U.S. ambassador to India, is not necessarily a good sign. He doesn't really know much about India. It's a campaign off a campaign debt. There is no visible persons in the State Department, National Security Council, and so forth who seem to know much about India, much less care much about India. Obama is very well regarded in India. We have just spent January through March this year and returned just recently for a short visit, and that is a tremendous asset. But as for the Obama administration, what it's going to do with India, how it's going to act towards India, in my view, is a great big question mark. And I don't know how long I've gone, but I'm going to very quickly one more point about Indo-U.S. relations, and that is the global issues question, where there is some possibilities of cooperation and some difficulties. Start with climate change. India and China are resisting the idea of having specific targets implemented by them by state action in the upcoming and ongoing climate change negotiations. The Obama administration has, of course, made an enormous U-turn change. America is now in the head, in the lead, in talking about climate changes. It's said to have wonderful effects on the talks around the world. Whether it's going to get India to commit to specific targets, actionable targets, is another question. So I think there's some possibility, but not a great possibility of India really getting on board in a big way there. Trade, not good either, because the ongoing Doha rounds where agriculture is the big sticking point, all third world economies where they can make some money exporting agricultural products. But Europe and America, of course, are notoriously subsidizing their farmers, having cheap agricultural products, and keeping the third. And India and Brazil and are among those leading voices in these trade talks, which want to dismantle agricultural protection in India, in the U.S. and Europe. Nuclear proliferation, also a tough one, because, of course, George Bush administration made India a nuclear, recognized nuclear power. The NPT, Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, has five privileged countries, U.S., Britain, France, China, Russia, who, having had nuclear explosions and weapons at the time of the making of the NPT, were said to be the only countries who were allowed to have nuclear weapons. And this, of course, India didn't like at all, and I won't go to the whole history of how India got its nuclear weapons, but in fact, in 98, May, June, they had their explosions and became a nuclear power, and that was, they were ostracized for a while, but now George Bush, with this nuclear agreement, has legitimized India's nuclear weapons. So what does the future hold? The Obama administration is divided, in my reading, between the very strong section of the Democratic Party who want to pursue nuclear non-proliferation, and those people who might be willing to go ahead with the nuclear agreement with India. The silver lining is this. President Obama gave a speech in Prague about a month ago, in which he declared himself in favor of a world without nuclear weapons, the zero option, you might say. And this echoes what Rajiv Gandhi, Prime Minister of India in 1986, something called the Delhi Declaration, which was exactly the same thing as what Obama called for, a world without nuclear weapons. India's position has been that is the goal, and we have these, as long as there are nuclear weapons in the world, we need deterrence. We're going to have these, and we're not going to be made a second-class or fifth-class citizen by not having nuclear weapons. We're going to have our nuclear sovereignty. But so there is agreement between India and China, India and U.S. on this question. I think I'm going to, I don't know how long I've gone, but I've gone very fast over a lot of points, but I think I'll stop.
The first point I want to talk about is the disaster of leadership that Pakistan suffered early on in its history. Jinnah was, on the whole, committed to democracy and constitutionalism, to a what you might call a rationalist secularism, despite his commitment to Islam. He died early. He might have led Pakistan into a period of trial and error of its democracy, which would have been much healthier than the period it finally found itself tossed into. Not only did Jinnah die, but Liaquat Ali Khan, who was an alternative leader who might have, again, offered the kind of leadership we all thought new democracies needed, also died. Now, we contrast this with the Indian situation. This is a matter of historical fortune rather than historical choice. Nehru was prime minister for 17 years. He was committed to constitutionalism and democracy, and he was able to provide a stable kind of government and stable kind of leadership which was friendly to democracy and stable and durable. The second point that I would want to emphasize is the... Before I do that, what was the consequence of this loss of leadership in Pakistan? It means that after 1958, essentially the lacuna in leadership was filled by the civil service and the military, which again threw politics in a certain direction. The military and the bureaucrats happily took the place of what they regarded as politicians as scallywags, who needed the kind of substitution that military and bureaucracy could provide. The second point has to do with the impact of the Cold War on Pakistan and the dynamics of the Cold War, especially the dynamics of the U.S. search for allies, which resulted in strong levels of military support for military leadership in Pakistan, and in some ways hardened and froze the pattern of military and bureaucratic leadership in Pakistan. The Indian comparison is difficult and a little divergent. There was no U.S. support for military activity in India, which gave India a kind of free hand with respect to its domestic and international politics that Pakistan did not have. India was less, quote, guided, despite its attachment to Soviet policy and friendship with the Soviet Union. It was never under the kind of guidance that or pressures that Pakistan found due to the American alliance. The third point has to do with what I would call the crisis of federalism and majoritarianism, democratic majoritarianism, that is, the crisis of East Pakistan. When the Awami League emerged as victor in the 1970 elections in East Pakistan, the path of the Awami League to its deserved position was blocked by Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who decided not to let his party lose. In some ways, learning to lose is one of the important pedagogies of democracy. It's a pedagogy that Bhutto did not pick up. And it meant it's a federal crisis in part because the West Pakistan states, particularly Punjab, never fully recognized the constitutional autonomy of East Pakistan. And so what, in order to solve that crisis, not only did should the Awami League have been allowed to rule, but there would have had to be some recognition of East Pakistan as a viable member of the Federal Union. What does all that have to do with the future of Indian of Pakistani democracy and stateness? The leadership situation. It's very interesting. If you go over all the available leadership possibilities in Pakistan just now, you come up with a relatively pessimistic position. There is nobody who, besides once Benazir died, there is no obvious legitimate leadership left in Pakistan in the younger ranks that one would mention would immediately take the place of Zardari once he was elected out of chosen out of office. That leads you in a pessimistic direction. On the other hand, there are some longer forces that one could look at for a slightly more optimistic view. Despite everything else that's been going on in Pakistan, the last 2 years have suggested that the middle class, the Pakistan middle class, is strengthening, has more of an identity, has more of a political possibility as a presence. And the lawyer role in Indian, in Pakistan politics in the last few years, in some ways is a confirmation of the fact that the middle class is capable of spawning some kind of leadership. So we see no leaders, but we see possible conditions for spawning of leadership. The effect of international relations on Pakistani politics. We may, in fact, see a repeat of the previous unhappy picture. If the international order, particularly U.S., the alliance with the U.S., froze a authoritarian government in Pakistan over the 50s and 60s, the fact that the U.S. is about to send in 21,000 more troops suggests that the military will be strengthened again by the kind of politics that will be carried on in the next few years. So in some ways, again, the dice are likely to come down on the side of a repeat of a previous authoritarian experience. As far as the third point is concerned, the real problem is the changing structure of the Pakistan state. What East Pakistan, the problem that East Pakistan threw up, which was never handled in a systematic political way, is that the federal system had to be rethought. Instead of rethinking the federal system, the Pakistan center in some ways treated Baluchistan, Northwest Frontier Province, the other states as secondary units to Punjab. And in some ways, one would wonder whether a constitutional convention which rethought the federal relationships might not provide a political context which was more favorable to Pakistan than the one that she has now. But the whole federal relationship, both the politics of federalism and the legal basis of federalism, needs some rethinking in order to avoid some the kinds of mistakes that were made in East Pakistan. Having heard today's comments, in which the problems of ethnic communities and of political subgroups have been explored, it's a little hard to imagine so old-fashioned an instrument as a constitutional convention coming together in Pakistan, but it's conceivable that it might make a difference if it were, came, it were to come in.
About a year and a half ago, Manmohan Singh declared with absolute confidence that the gravest threat to India resided in the problem of the Naxalites, who have not been mentioned in this gathering at all. And the Naxalites, incidentally, control, it is estimated by some scholars, up to 20% of the districts of India. That is, that the areas of India which are heavily under some form of Naxalite influence. There are various divisions, by the way, between the Naxals themselves. You know, if there are 30, 40 factions of the Taliban, I can tell you there are almost as many of the Naxalites as well. But if you're looking at the Naxalites in India, the question would be, how does one juxtapose them against the Taliban, for example? That is to say that I think that there was this attempt to talk about India shining, a discourse by which I don't think much of India was seduced, given that in 2004, before this election, the BJP, which had actually put out the whole campaign of India shining, suffered electoral defeat. Particularly, the most stunning defeat was that of Chandrababu Naidu, who was somebody who fancied himself as the epitome of India shining, you know, right? It is a discourse that has, it seems to me, seduced the West more and has therefore made us think that, well, India represents a model of a shining democracy as well, not just shining economic growth, despite all of its limitations. And on the other hand, you have what the Economist described when they talked about Pakistan, namely the most dangerous place on earth, right? But it seems to me that it's very clear that there are elements that are in common to the Naxalites in India and the Taliban in Pakistan. And one of them is, if I may put it this way, the state. That is, the state is not there, if I may put it this way. Right? I mean, so, you know, if I may revert back to the case of the Hindi film, I mean, one of the most common things that happens in the popular Hindi film is that the police always arrive a little bit too late. They always arrive a little bit too late. And it seems to me that this is a question and a problem that goes back to the time of colonial India, because there is this whole question as to what was the reach of the colonial state. And it seems to me that it's very clear that there are large pockets of India and large segments of its population which never really came under the umbrella of the colonial state. Right? And these are precisely those areas where the Naxalites, in some respect, have been the most important in India. And my submission to you is that to some degree, this is one way one might want to look at what is being described as the Taliban or the jihadi element in Pakistan. Right? And so this is merely a suggestion as to how one might want to, in fact, actually, as I said, put into contrast and juxtaposition these two elements. Now, to me, there is one fundamental question which I think has been talked about by the preceding speakers to considerable degree, but I want to put it in a slightly different framework. Juan Campo mentioned it, a number of other people have mentioned it, and that is the kind of plurality of Islam, if I may put it this way, that one finds in South Asia. But I wish to press this point much further and try to see what one could extrapolate from it and link it also to a suggestion that Richard had made, a suggestion that I am entirely in agreement with, namely that we need, it seems to me, a much more subtle understanding of what self-determination means, because so long as we confine it to a kind of a legalistic, formalistic framework, it seems to me that we're not going to be able to really speak about the various idioms in which self-determination actually operates in these areas. Right? And so the suggestion that had been made about the plurality of Islam is, and the manner in which I want to push it further is the following. That it seems to me that what has happened in Pakistan, especially since the time of Zia-ul-Haq, but you could say that perhaps it begins a little bit earlier, is a deliberate attempt in Pakistan to disown an Indo-Islamic synthesis. That is that before Pakistan was a nation state and before India was a nation state, they were part of a certain Indic civilization. And I think that one of the key elements of that civilization, okay, is an Indo-Islamic cultural synthesis that was accomplished over several centuries. And it seems to me that South Asian Islam in that sense is fundamentally different. That yes, there's something in common between South Asian Islam and the Islam of the Middle East, so to speak, right? But that what I'm trying to suggest here is that there has been an attempt to disown, if I may put it this way, Pakistan's place in that cultural, religious, political synthesis, you see. Right? So it's, which of course in part explains why the Wahhabi element or the Salafi element has come in, okay, has lodged itself into the consciousness of some portion of the population, right? But this point, I think, is more than simply an explication, if I may put it this way, of the plurality of Islam. Because because my submission would be that you're going to find that plurality. I mean, if you go to Southeast Asia, I mean, you certainly find a plurality of Islam there as well, right? But it seems to me that here we are talking about a problem where Pakistan wants to, as I'm putting it to you this way, disown that particular cultural synthesis, which means it is disowning a part of itself. And therefore, if one is going to speak about self-determination, right, and try to arrive at a particular conception of self-determination that might be a richer conception, we have to think about civilizational idioms of dialogue. I mean, so far, it seems to me that all the parameters that we have looked at in order to try to locate this conflict are what I'm going to describe as parameters of the nation state. Right? So these are conversations that are taking place as to how does one actually operate within the rubric of the nation state, and the solutions are what you might describe as nation state solutions. But it seems to me that self-determination here means in part that we have to think about a civilizational discourse that is much more important in South Asia than has hitherto been realized in some respects. Because if we're going to speak about nation-state solutions, then it seems to me that we invariably run into the problem that is that we have to confront the logic of the nation-state, and the logic of the nation-state is a kind of zero-sum politics, right? And so if we have the zero-sum politics, I think we're going to be constantly talking about, well, if you put down one group over here, well, how is it going to affect, you know, another group there? How is it going to affect India, right? If you decrease jihadi activity in some parts of Pakistan, well, maybe it will gravitate towards Kashmir, so forth and so on. You see what I mean, right? That this is what I'm describing as a kind of a zero-sum politics, which is the politics, it seems to me, of the nation-state. And so there is, it seems to me, a way in which one could speak about what I'm describing as a kind of a civilizational discourse, right? And I think the condition for entering into that discourse is that there has to be an admission. There has to be an admission that Pakistan is in fact part of that civilizational discourse too, right? That the gravitas, that the center of Pakistan's being does not reside with an affinity with the Islam of the Middle East, if I may put it this way. And I understand that even that is a generic category, but I'm using that simply as a mode of argument here, you know. But that rather the Islam, which has been generated in Pakistan, right, is part of a certain kind of cultural synthesis that arose in that part of the world. So I think I would simply end with these two observations. Thank you.
Beginning with Professor Embry's presentation this morning and continuing all the way through to Professor Vinay Lal's comments just now. Clearly, one theme was that however we envision the future of U.S. relations with India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, the future is theirs. It's their future, and the U.S. has to look at the role that it's played historically and continues to play in affecting a future that rightfully belongs to the peoples of those countries, and to try to make more modest and more responsive, as well as responsible, our relationship to the futures that those peoples want for themselves. But in keeping with this, then, is the second point. This is one that was made by Professor Mahmood in remarking that so frequently, and I can attest that I've heard this also in speaking with government people when they're trying to understand why those people respond the way they do. It's often that they don't see that those people are often responding to us. They're not only responding to us in the United States, but our meddling and our persistent presence militarily, economic, cultural, within those regions, which had a historic background, as the speakers, especially in the first session, asked us to consider. So in understanding that presence is a part of the problem, I think one of the conclusions to which we have all come is that particularly the military aspect of America's presence in South Asia is simply enhancing the way in which that presence is perceived and making it far more difficult for our relationships to develop on anything like a more congenial state. Put simply, we're making matters worse. And the startling statistics that Mona Sheikh presented that the overwhelming percentage of people in Pakistan regard America as the problem, some 44% compared to, 14% for al-Qaeda or the Taliban, I think should give us as pause and make us realize that it's not just the increase in number of troops, but also these unmanned drones, the stories about mistreatment of prisoners, which never appear on American television. You know, the story that Mona told strikes most of us as news. We hadn't heard it before. It was all over Pakistan, television and newspapers, but not in the United States. We don't see the way we're perceived there. And to see that perception, I think, would certainly make us give us pause about any kind of military solution to the situation. The third is the whole issue of the Islamic political presence in the region, particularly in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And 2 points were made about that. One is through Juan Campo's excellent exposition and Mona Sheikh's to see the diversity of the different kinds of Islamic political organizations and Islamic movements and gives indication that there's a complexity here. It's not a simple issue. It's not a simple matter of religious politics are about to seize control. The power of these movements often are absurdly small. Their threat, certainly as united presence, is certainly not great. And yet, of course, it is a problematic aspect of the politics in that region. But to exaggerate it is a problem. To simplify it as if there was a Taliban or a single kind of Islamic politics that was present is certainly a part of our mistake in the region. And that leads to the fourth point, that there are forms of cultural politics that we can live with. This absurd notion that the only form of political organization is one that's shaped out of the enlightened experience of secularism, a kind of created notion and an attempt by French intellectuals to try to put religion in a box that now has become a dominant trope of political thought even into the 21st century, that there should be this clear distinction between religion and secular politics, which has never quite worked even in the West, much less in other parts of the world. I think it's something that has to be re-examined not just philosophically, but in terms of our politics and finding a way to live with Islamic and even Hindu politics, in the case of the BJP, and to see it simply as another form of politics and not as a threat to political order. And then finally, the fifth theme that seemed to be floating through all of the comments, including Vinay Lal's most recent comments, is the issue of the regional solutions. And he pointed out, I think, quite wisely, there's several kinds of regions. And there's several different ways of thinking of the region, beginning with South Asia as a region itself, and the Kashmir issue being a dominant problem. And to understand, as Ainslie said, that it's a, and I think Cynthia Mahmood said the same thing, it's a matter of Kashmiri autonomy. It's a kind of a recognition of their own presence as a people, separate from both India and Pakistan, that has to be a part of the calculation of India and Pakistan learning to live with each other in the context of a Kashmiri solution. And the same is true with India and Afghanistan over the Pashtun issue. The Durand line didn't really make any sense. You have a political solution problem in part because of a kind of error of British geography that then continues to be a situation that those will have to be dealt with within the region. And then there are the other regions of which these groups are a part. In the case of Islam, in the case of Pakistan, it does face west as well as east. It does look at Saudi Arabia and other Islamic countries in the Middle East. And that has to be also a part of the reckoning. And Monty mentioned the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the fact that India also looks east. So there are the other regional associations that are players, that are part of the solution, and that U.S. policy cannot act as if all of these countries only relate to it, that it's the only player in the region. So it seems we have these five clear themes about which there seem to be a certain
consensus. I know there's some shadings and difference in, among us in each one of them, but they might provide a framework for a policy statement of what we feel are significant points for any administration, and especially the Obama administration at the current moment, to take in consideration in viewing its policies towards the region. So now we have time for a conversation. I would like to ask any of the panel members to respond, first of all, to anything I've said or each other have said, and then open up the discussion to everyone. Yes, Vinay.
Yeah, I just, is this on?
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah. I just wanted to add one observation. You know that I think we might also want to think about what are the forms of remembering and erasure that take place mm-hmm. in any society and any civilization. So we could make a distinction, for example, and I think it's been suggested in a way, between, for example, the kind of Wahhabi influence that has clearly permeated segments of Pashtun society, and distinguish that from, let's say, Sindh, where clearly the Sufi forms of Islam are much more predominant. And certainly, as far as I know, I don't think the Taliban have had anything like the kind of leeway in Sindh that they've had in other parts of Pakistan, most of the parts of Pakistan. But here it seems to me it's important to add yet another distinction, and that is that even among the Pashtuns, I mean, let us not forget that Mohandas Gandhi himself thought that the greatest exponent of ahimsa, nonviolence, was Badshah Khan. And Badshah Khan, in fact, raised a whole army, the Khudai Khidmatgars. And there is an enormous lore. Somehow, when we start talking about the Khudai Khidmatgars, we reduce it to Badshah Khan. But there is an enormous poetry, enormous lore, mm-hmm. and literature there. Mm-hmm. Because the question here would be, why is it that that is not remembered among the Pashtuns themselves? Mm-hmm. Why has there been an erasure of that part of their legacy? Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me that that could be instructive and it could be useful to try to create a different kind of climate of thinking, mm-hmm. right? And something that seems to be more organic to that society, I think, would be far more welcome than some kind of policy coming from top down, you know. Right? So I think that in general, I think it would be instructive, I would argue, to think also about how is it that forms of erasure, remembering, and history function in any kind of society, you know?
Excellent. Well, I didn't, Suzanne, do you want to add anything to this?
Yes, I want to pick up, I think it's on your fifth point, which is, I'm afraid I went a little too fast over my points. Anyway, left out the idea that Manu Mohanty also did quite a bit of this with the idea of regional organization. You mentioned regional organizations, and you mentioned cooperation in South Asia. I think starting with the cooperation in South Asia, I think we, and thinking in terms of, you know, what a memo for the Obama administration, the cooperation between India and Pakistan is a very big thing. And I think they both face a non-state actor, you know, terrorist violence, shall we say, or and civil rebellion. Leave aside the Naxalite side of it for the moment, but Zardari said, you know, in one of his speeches that after all, Bennett, my wife, was killed by these people, and they've attacked in Lahore the cricket match, and they've done this and that. So, you know, he is, and he, it was in the context of him saying, we in Pakistan and you in India share a common threat, a common enemy, a common security problem. So there is a basis for India and Pakistan thinking about this common threat, common security problem is one way of moving. Now, SARC has, I think explicitly, but anyway, de facto left out security questions in terms of its regional cooperation, thing to do, culture and trade and so forth, but here's a way of moving, and by the way, it's important to remember, everyone should keep in mind that a few years ago, Afghanistan became part of SARC, so it's part of the regional cooperation. So I think one thing is to stress regional cooperation with respect to security when we're dealing with non-state actors, terrorist threats, and that kind of insecurity. So that's what I was throwing.
Great. We'll open up to general discussion, Juan.
In terms of thinking about, if you're thinking about some kind of policy statement.
Microphone is coming.
Mm-hmm. Yes, if you're thinking about a kind of policy statement, one thing that has come up a little bit, but maybe not enough, is relating to Lloyd's mentioning of the fact that Obama has appointed this Tony Romer to be Tim Romer to be the new U.S. ambassador to India, knowing nothing about the region. Right? Is I correct in that? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me it comes from this kind of Tom Friedman view of the world. The world is flat. It doesn't make any difference. You just move this part to that part, and the system somehow will work out if we can just get it logically organized enough and things. But Vinay talked about this idea of, you know, remembering the past and the distinctiveness of the different cultures there and invoking some of that in terms of envisioning a new future. And it seems like we're not going to be able to get there until we sort of get into the details of the histories of these different regions, their diversities, that history makes a difference, that the world is not a world of interchangeable parts and it's not flat. And as part of those histories are also the distinctions that come about through language. Mm-hmm. And so how many of Obama's new people are versed in the languages, let alone the histories of this region? And if they're not, we're just going to be repeating the same kinds of mistakes that we did with Bush, where, again, history didn't make any difference. We're there to make history, not to recognize it as a vital factor in helping us make
our
policy.
Yeah, that point was particularly surprising because his appointment to China is, you know, was somebody who spoke Mandarin quite fluently, and that was a big issue made out of that.
No, no, wait a minute. Huntsman. Mm-hmm. No, he doesn't speak Chinese, I don't think. He does?
Oh, yeah. He was a Mormon missionary.
The other thing is that he's supposed to know a huge amount about India and participate in holidays and so forth. There was an editorial or somewhere in, Wall Street Journal or The Times saying Huntsman should have gone to India. I mean, yeah. But anyway.
It's Manu Mahanti. Microphone is coming.
Yeah. So, two small comments on the earlier discussion, and then I'll one more response. I think you have summarized very well. I think that's our ground point. Now, the point about comparing India and Pakistan. While I agree with Suzanne about the sort of the good fortune of India, I think it has to be nuanced the way Vinay suggested, but more by way of sort of placing our arguments vis-a-vis the popular notions about Pakistan and Pakistan-like situations in other parts of the world that dominates American public opinion, which, you know, extends to arguments like Islam versus democracy. You know, Islam is hostile to democracy. Or the question earlier was about Pakistani army. Most Americans believe that you need an army to clear that mess and things like that without understanding the historical process and the kind of leadership situation that you described and how America actually has contributed to the consolidation of the army in Pakistan and in many parts of the world. Therefore, this democratic India versus authoritarian Pakistan, when we present the complexity of these contrasting experiences, we have to keep this in mind. Vinay, I fully agree with the Indo-Islamic or the larger Indic context where Islam is a part, Indic meaning not Hindu at all. I mean, Indic is the civilizational, geospatial, geocultural region from Nile to Japan or something like that. But there is a battle over interpreting that. I mean, there is a I mean, we see that every day in India, the Hindu fundamentalist attempt to inherit that, and so on. While we present a civilizational dialogue, let us acknowledge the terms of that dialogue. Who is determining those terms? How? Is there a uncritical, homogenized, monolithic view of Indic tradition? Or there are contrasting pluralistic trends and so on. Now, just one point about the framework that Mark has suggested, and I think that can be the basis of the...
The five points.
Sorry?
The 5 points.
Yeah, just one general comment on that, on the 5 points. Yeah, the Panchashil of a future. I think we have to somehow reconcile the present with a larger perspective. And I have a feeling that most of these formulations are responding to the present. Beneath each point there is a larger historical, civilizational, cultural perspective. I think that has to come out more clearly. Future by them, yes, but... we also know of the interconnected, larger civilizational history of these peoples, and America is saying that we are there to enable you to have your democracy in Afghanistan or in Iraq, and things like that. Mm-hmm. That is just one example. But somehow we have to have a method of locating policy in the kind of historical, civilizational, and larger political contexts that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Bridget.
Suzanne,
did you want to make a point?
Yeah, I just wanted to...
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to emphasize the importance of some of the sort of historical comparisons we would make in the course of such 5 points, that the Obama surge, because it cannot address the social and political problems of Afghanistan, is in great danger of exacerbating rather than improving the political problems of Afghanistan. And it's because winning the war is not possible, there's great danger that the unfortunate example of the Vietnam experience will be re-experienced. It seems to me that some language that reminds us of the past in this respect and puts it rather sharply, that there's great danger here. Everybody's been extraordinarily accepting of the surge. There's been very little criticism. Mm-hmm. And I think any point...
Without any sense of the kind of consequences that might... Yes. It could become Obama's Vietnam.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I just have a question for Lloyd. You said that... in the present context, India may not figure that prominently in U.S. policy. It's again Pakistan.
Say that again. U.S. may not.
Obama may not consider India to be very important,
yes,
vis-à-vis,
yes,
Pakistan. But my question is, in the context of in 50s, because of Nehru policy towards Soviet Union, U.S. wanted to invest more in Pakistan.
Yeah.
And now in the context of China, so don't you think, it would like to cultivate India as well? Both of them are emerging economies and, challenging U.S. power. So that is one. And to Mark Panchasil, are you forgetting one component, which is civil society stakeholders? You know, they should be including women's group. To be their stakeholders while negotiating in the peace process. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good.
Well, I realize I went much too fast over many points. Okay, it's certainly true that in the time of George Bush and Manmohan Singh, India-U.S., negotiating the nuclear agreement, one of the ways in which George Bush got political support in the U.S., in the Congress in particular, but in public opinion up to a point, was to say that India was going to balance and check China, part of a balance of power argument. And the question is, to what extent is the Obama administration going to be happy and continue with the nuclear agreement? Probably yes. But to what extent will they want to have good relations with India in order to check China, whether the Obama administration is going to be thinking of balance of power view of the situation? I'm not sure. Obama has said repeatedly that, in contrast to Bush's unilateralism and you're with us or against us kind of thing, he wants to be a multilateralist. Also, he has indicated pretty strongly that he's for persuasion and diplomacy, making military threats and so forth and interventions to get things done. So that is against the idea of sort of using India against China. I think I'll just throw in this one thing. What happened during the Bush administration, relationships with India, which I think you have to understand in order to think about what Obama might be doing. There is in international relations a standard idea of balance of power, but there's also something called bandwagoning. What Bush said to India was, we're the big power in the world. We're the winners. You bandwagon with us. You join us because you want to be on the winning side. And up to a point, on the surface, this is what India did. But I just want to say this in terms of how we should think about the Obama administration acting vis-a-vis India. Because India, on the one hand, did up to a point bandwagon rather with the U.S., the big power. On the other hand, India is continues to play a kind of balance of power game. Professor Mohanty mentioned the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and other ways in which India is acting in a balance of power way. India is also pursuing, despite huge pressure by Bush's time, I won't go into all the details, of being against Iran, India is cooperating and wants to cooperate with Iran. There's a gas pipeline. There's the highway down through into Iran from through Afghanistan, giving Afghanistan access to the sea without having to go through Pakistan. Anyway, India is wants to cooperate with Iran, which is different than going along with U.S. policy. So India, which I did talk about, I should say, this is relevant to how to think about how we should approach any message to the Obama administration, is, I think, reviving what you might call a neo-non-aligned game. Doesn't want a bandwagon with the U.S., it's a great power. That's less of an option with Bush gone. It doesn't want to play entirely balance of power games. This kind of neo-non-alignment, which is to say compatible with what I call India's strength, which is a soft power strength, speaking with many voices and being many things to many people, is the way we want to go. So, and that's a long answer to your question about China. I don't think Obama is inclined by temperament, because of his multilateral kind of view and persuasion and so forth, to do this balance of power with China. On the other hand, it is a terrific political resource in conducting foreign policy to with the Congress and with the public for having strong relations with India. If you can sell strong relations with India, saying, hey, it's going to help us with China.
Since we have just a few minutes left, I want to end with our three of our core. You had a chance to speak, Mono, but Ainsley Embry and Mona Sheikh and Richard Falk were also part of the organizing group if they want to have any concluding thoughts. And I also want to give Professor Gurinder Singh Mann and Amandeep Sandhu, both of whom know the regions well, to add a point or raise a question if you wish to do so. Professor Mann?
Not really. I think what I may have to say wouldn't really fit in the framework in which the discussion took place, because we are thinking in terms of nation states, and the people I know well don't have a nation. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I can take you back to 1947 and the Sikh leadership I sort of grew up with. Their analysis of that particular point in history was that the Sikhs had the option of choosing between going for cholera or tuberculosis. Becoming part of Pakistan would be a direct attack, and how do you protect yourself? Or staying on in India and having to fight this slow battle. So that was 1947. That's the way Sikh leadership put it, at least the people I knew. And interestingly, ironically, this week marks the 25th anniversary of Operation Blue Star. So in some ways, the most important challenge
attack
to
on the Golden Temple in 1984.
Attack on the Darbar Sahib Amritsar. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the most important challenge to Indian democracy came and went. And in some interesting ways, you know, I think our conversation does make one point amply clear, that people in high places don't really have access to thick description of the area. Mm-hmm. So whether they think Gurkhas are in Pakistan or other examples we have come across. But in the larger scheme of things, these regional issues, these issues, albeit the Ahmadiyyas in Pakistan or the Sikhs in India, do they really fit in? I am not so sure. That may be going a little too far. Thank mm-hmm. you.
Thank you. Thank you. Amandeep, did you want to say anything? I've never known you to be shy.
What to me interesting was what Vinay Lal said about the civilizational idiom. But, you know, thinking about the in the 90s, the great transformation, I think, in the Indian policy, foreign policy in the whole of the region, which goes from Pakistan on to the Middle East, is the shift towards Israel. The recognition of Israel in 1992, which came about in a certain version, is because of the economic crisis and India was going to the IMF. And at that point, one of the factors was that the Israeli lobby in U.S. will stand in the way of India getting the loan. So this is Manmohan Singh was supposed to be coming to Washington. Was it? I think Narasimha Rao. Obviously, Manmohan Singh was the finance minister, but Narasimha Rao was supposed to come to Washington. And 7 days before he came to Washington, India recognized and established full diplomatic relations with Israel. And then through the 90s, the role that Israeli lobby in the U.S. has played in terms of what's been going on in South Asia has not really been covered in our conversations today, in terms of, you know, planning about the Islamic bomb that Pakistan has, which might then be supplied to Saudi Arabia, or thinking about how India has become so central in terms of the global business, and what is the role in that axis, Israel, U.S., and also within the, I think, the larger political structure in the U.S. So I just want to underline that relationship in the region.
Mm-hmm. Good. I'd like to give my three co-organizers a chance to have a final word. But Cynthia, did you want to add something to Amandeep's comments?
I just had to say something.
Would you please give Cynthia the mic? Oh, good.
I just have to say a quick word now that Gurinder has spoken. I feel a slight discomfort with some of the rhetoric that's come up now and then about, you know, say India and Pakistan have a shared interest in fighting against Islamic terrorism or something like that. You know, the statist language that we've kind of adopted. Mm-hmm. And maybe when you write up our five comments, you could just sort of pay attention to that the Obama administration has been careful not to wholesale adopt the war on terror terminology of the Bush administration. And I think, at least I feel, I think probably many of you share, that we don't want to say that in the long term, you know, world peace is to be established by a banding together of states against sub-state actors. Mm-hmm. You know, that, in other words, the powerful against the powerless. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be part of that.
And Bidget made something the same point, talking about civil society and its role. Mm-hmm. Ainsley, Mona, and Richard Falk. Ainsley, do you want to make a closing comment? We'll bring the microphone to you. You don't have to move an inch.
There was one point made by Richard Falk this morning that was very important, about self-determination. Countries like India think self-determination was solved in 1947. It's clear that self-determination, in a way, is just beginning. Mm-hmm. And a new issue will in Pakistan with Balochistan, and somewhere, again, it's been emphasized, we are obsessed with terrorism. Pakistan is not. India is to an extent. But India doesn't need our help to deal with terrorism. And I think one of the great errors that Obama and Americans are making in general, this feeling that we decide for countries like India and Pakistan what their response to terrorism is to be. Mm-hmm. They have very different needs. And I have many criticisms of the Obama administration. And I think those two may be very important. The failure to recognize the demand for self-determination in groups in South Asia. And secondly, that we believe that all the world is as obsessed with terrorism as we are. I think this great error in that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Wonderful conference.
Thank you, Ainsley. Mona Sheikh.
Is this on? Yeah. I was just sitting and I thinking about a paradox we have here in regard to, you know, we are recommending a more regional approach, a broader approach to understanding the issues. At the same time, it would not be correct to propose a policy that it leads the U.S. to engage in many more countries, you know, going from Afghanistan to Pakistan and to India, then that would be, you know, a problematic consequence of being more, you know, broadly approaching this issue. So what if our policy
being regional, we don't mean send more troops to the other countries as well.
But that could easily be understood as a consequence because that would be a more regional approach.
Yeah.
Instead, much more, you know, we need to, if we take, you know, base the policy recommendation on the premises that are, you know, the status now that U.S. troops are in Afghanistan and increasingly focusing on Pakistan, a good advice would be to try to narrow down the Taliban enemy. That would be a concrete, you know, advice to try to, because what Obama did when he launched his new strategy on Afghanistan and Pakistan was to broaden the battlefield and say that it's not only in Afghanistan because the problems are interconnected. And everybody agrees, yeah, the problems are, the issues are interconnected. But the solution is then not, you know, consequence that Obama's policy is drawing from this is to, act more broadly both in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and maybe in the next step will be in other countries also. So it's more to narrow down, actually isolate who is the enemy, try to narrow down the Taliban enemy, and localizing actually the conflict instead of making it drawing it into the war on terrorism. For example, the issues in Sawat is a good example of a problem that that was a local issue. It was a local Pakistani police matter. It was a group of criminals establishing parallel administration. That's unlawful in Pakistan. So it was a local police matter, but now it has become a global issue, militarized, and has become a matter of militarized matter. And how can we demilitarize? And we should suggest some means or tools to some concrete tools to demilitarize and actually localize conflicts that are best handled by local actors, such as the Pakistani police force or other civil kind of actors on the ground. So that was just my thought on that.
Yes. Roy, do you want to hop in?
I appreciate what you're saying. I want to stress the only reason I mentioned security cooperation between India and Pakistan, and they did both have kinds of attacks, is my main point is how to get India and Pakistan to cooperate rather than be in a conflict relationship. And Vinay has talked about the civilization. I mean, one thing I don't know we could do. I mean, this statement is very delicate. India and Pakistan were launched on a series of peace or negotiations to make relations better. They improved trade relations. They improved cultural relations. They were. Just before the 2611 Mumbai attacks, there were about five different initiatives which were making considerable progress. So, then you have to say, well, the Obama administration should. How can you put it without saying we're meddling in? Mm-hmm. But we want to facilitate any way in which India and Pakistan can talk to each other and cooperate. Now, this is state stuff. The fact is, these are two countries, they're two states, they're two sovereign countries. So, but the big problem in South Asia is among the biggest problems, even Afghanistan, which is related to all this on the side, is how to get India and Pakistan to cooperate and find vehicles and processes and means and substantive policy areas for them to do so. So I only threw that security in there because one way they have to share intelligence, they have to do police work together, they have to do this and that, and that's something they could do, as well as revive these talks, which were very promising. In fact, Zardari has said several times he wants to revive them. And Manmohan Singh, now that he's won his big election, has the freedom to do so. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how to work this in, but mm-hmm. it's something very important in my view.
Certainly we encourage and we support this kind of cooperation within the region as they solve the problems among themselves. Yeah. It's not for us to solve, but we're certainly delighted that and we certainly won't be standing in their way. Manu, do you want to have a last comment, and then Richard? Manu, and then Richard.
I just want to say that when we say government-to-government cooperation, it is also subject to civil society pressures on governments. We have to get the visas. We have to get army to be withdrawn. We want more peacekeeping measures and so on. In fact, SAARC has a counter-terrorism task force. Mm. That has not been activated. I mean, they should
South
meet
Asia
and
Regional
discuss.
Council. Sorry, the South Asia Regional Council. Yeah.
Yeah, South mm-hmm. Asian Association of Regional Cooperation. Similarly, the civil society initiatives and their pressure, which has opened up communications between the two countries. The three open points now in line of control. in Kashmir, and the railway link across in Rajasthan, yeah, in Sindh, Kokrajhar. And so, therefore, when we say that, of course, Wagha border, you know, he mentioned all those initiatives of cooperation that were going on. So it's not that we should not talk about government-to-government cooperation. I think that's very important. India-Pakistan have a nuclear confidence-building task force, and they used to meet. And that has now been suspended after the Mumbai attacks. So I think somewhere from civilization to transnational dimensions to intergovernmental and regional cooperation to civil society, you know, we have to have various layers of these linkages to be recognized, you know, at every level.
Right. SARC is the South Asia Association for Regional Cooperation, SSA, S-A-A-R-C. Richard Falk.
Let me make first a raise a procedural kind of question that relates to the nature of the audience for this kind of statement, because it seems to me that there's a real choice to be made between the kind of consensus that seems to have prevailed within our discussions and the kind of policy assessments that the Obama leadership would be prepared to listen to.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there's a real choice. Well, let me put it in a very concrete way. I don't think it makes... If you take seriously what we've been saying, I don't think it makes any sense to have this particular military commander, McChrystal, running the American military presence in Afghanistan, and it sends precisely the wrong signal from... So if we're serious about what we are saying, we have to be prepared, it seems to me, to say it in a fairly... to draw some of the concrete implications. But if we draw those concrete implications, it's almost certain that we won't be listened to or won't be listened to at a relevant level. And so I think there's a real issue of presentation that is, in one way, goes to the moral integrity of our effort. I mean, and to what extent we want to express ourselves as we believe, or we want to express ourselves in a more pragmatic way in terms of what this audience is likely to be prepared to listen to.
But wouldn't it be possible to do both in this sense, that is, state our concerns very emphatically, and then say the possible implications might be such things as, without pretending that we know all of the factors that are involved in any particular decision, but it seems apparent from the concerns that we have that this kind of action, the number of troops, this kind of appointment for leadership, it seems to be inconsistent with those concerns. But yes, we're not so dogmatic or pretentious that we wouldn't be able to be argued, listen to a counter argument. But we will certainly hold firm on those concerns that we have from our own scholarly and experiential background.
But doesn't this kind of document have a dual life? I mean, we're presumably talking about a letter to Marie Slaughter, or Marie Slaughter, or to some governmental body. On the other hand, presumably, even if it receives no attention there, if it also has a public audience, then the way opinion goes is it goes to a public audience, and the public audience presumably begins to develop some pressure on the governmental body.
Yeah, I think, you know, this goes to the heart of what is the public responsibility of academia. And I think we do have a public responsibility because we've studied hard and we know things. And we have, it seems to me, a moral and citizen obligation to indicate the consequences, the conclusions of our thinking for public policy, without pretending that we know all the answers about any specific decision that's made, but simply indicating that it seems to us that if you accept these concerns that we have, policy would most likely be quite different than what it has been.
Can I just supplement Richard Falk's concerns? He's raised, he calls it procedural. I think it's a terribly important thing and it's relevant to what everyone's saying. The question is, how about thinking about multi-targets? I mean, Anne-Marie Slaughter is one possibility, but you could also go for John Kerry, Richard Lugar, House and Senate, Foreign Affairs, Foreign Relations Committees. You could also go for who will pay attention, a press release, trying to make a news story of it. Because I see one of the things we could talk about is that the 21,000 troop surge is looking for Obama's Vietnam. Now, we can't put it that strongly, but in fact, I mean, I don't know whether there's a consensus on that, but I think this is a fundamental mistake. Mm-hmm. And are you going to, you know, that will not be heard, but it should be heard, and it should bring pressure on the to really start rethinking where they're going.
Mm-hmm. Yes, my intention was not really to solve this problem, but to feel that we need to be self-conscious about this issue of presentation and the kinds of concreteness that we're prepared to endorse. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it is terribly important for the reasons that Lloyd just indicated. I want to make just one substantive point, which is really to reiterate the sense that I do think we need a sixth point on I think self-determination is implicit in the other five in a way, but I feel it's so important.
It's part of the very first point that people have their own futures.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to articulate it in the language of self-determination, because that is a language that has resonance around the world. And And I think one of the contributions we can make is to clarify the deeper sense of what self-determination entails in the 21st post-colonial century. Mm-hmm. That it's not something that Woodrow Wilson resolved back after the First World War. Mm-hmm. It's a living process, and I think there may be a possibility of further signaling, potential way to signal some change in the fundamental American approach would be to put some language about respect for international law and the United, thinking about constructive roles for the United Nations, which we sort of haven't mentioned, but seems to me to be part of the normative framing of the kinds of concerns that have been expressed during the day.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a conversation that's going to continue, and we've started, I hope, a process and not come to any definitive conclusions. Did you want to make one additional statement, Mono?
One small point. I think the idea of the policy paper addressed to the government is not really only necessarily meant for the government. Mm. It's for the wider public. It's for South Asia and, you know, the public opinion making institutions all over the world. An alternative perspective on such issues in contemporary world. I think that is the importance of this exercise. It's not just an advice to the Obama administration. I mean, it will be submitted there, and they may call you to present it, or we can even hope that some congressional committee will invite some of you to present or discuss these issues and so on. But it's meant for the world you know, opinion-making process.
Right, and I think what we've demonstrated amply in this the discussions today is that we have such a richness of information and such a wealth of interpretive analysis to make a cogent statement not only to ourselves and to the academic world, but to the wider public about a part of the world that's very important, and a formation of American policy that has implications far beyond this particular region. Thank you all for being such a patient and deliberative audience, and I look forward to the continuing discussion as this topic continues to be a part of our personal conversations and the wider conversation in the academic community. Thanks for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.